Hello, and welcome to IEP Essentials Pro Tips Podcast, brought to you by Learning Essentials. Learning Essentials offers special education-based tutoring in your home by state-certified educators with advanced degrees in all areas of special education. IEP Essentials Pro Tips Podcast brings professionals together to educate and empower families navigating special education needs in the IEP process.
Hello and welcome to Pro Tips Podcast. I am your host, Wendy Taylor. Today we're talking about This Ship Is Sinking, Parents of Children with Disabilities Need a Lifeline, Advocacy During a Pandemic. We will be speaking with Laura Lorenzen. She is a proven special education leader in the Washington, D.C. area. She's also a parent of a child with special needs and passionate about ensuring the success of every child. Laura has spent nearly two decades leading innovative and quality programming for students with disabilities from early childhood through high school. She began her career at a non-public school for students with language-based learning disabilities, ADHD, and autism, before taking the helm as a director of student support at a DC public charter school, where it built its reputation as a local and national leader in quality, inclusive special education services. Under her leadership, the school was recognized in 2018 as one of only four nationwide centers of excellence by the National Center of Special Education and Charter Schools. In July 2020, Laura founded District Special Education Partners, an educational consulting and advocacy firm that builds on Laura's belief that schools and parents can and should be partners in educating children with special needs. So welcome to our podcast, Laura. I am very excited to speak with you today, especially on this topic about the ship is sinking, because I know that there's just so much happening in our world, especially with education and special education, that parents of children with disabilities certainly need a lifeline. And the hope is that you are that lifeline for our families and our kiddos. And part of your journey to coming and starting District Special Education Partners is you have that experience. Would you like to just kick it off today and tell us about the experience that you have with your daughter that really has helped shape who you are as an advocate that can really help empathize with families and support them in the way that they need to be supported?
Absolutely. Well, first, thank you for having me on today. I'm thrilled to be here talking with you and to share a bit of my own journey. So I now have a 22-year-old daughter. She has a series of disabilities, intellectual disabilities, motor challenges, all sorts of needs. But I really had no one to guide me through that process. Even from the time she was little, I had to figure out on my own that she needed to be evaluated and how to do that. And then I had to find the right school program for her. And at a certain point, unfortunately, I had to go up against a large school district that was refusing to provide her with an appropriate education. So I've even been through a due process case, which was draining and awful. And I hope no one ever has to go through that, but I know that parents do. I moved to a new school district. So I've just been through so much. And at the same time, I was engaged working in special education. Before I actually had my daughter, I had worked in a school setting for children with emotional disabilities, and I loved being in a school setting. I loved being immersed and being a part of a child's life, and I knew that was where I wanted to go. And so at the same time I was looking for schools for my daughter, I found out about a school that needed a counselor, and I became a counselor at that school, and my daughter began attending that school. And, you know, my journey has just continued through there. I worked as the director of student support at a public charter school running their program, and continued to have to work to find the right programs for my daughter as her needs changed over the years. So I've just always approached it as I think about what I would have wanted as a parent, and I've tried to offer that So even before I formally became a parent advocate, I really thought of myself as a parent advocate working in a school setting. I wanted to make sure that parents had everything that I didn't necessarily have, someone to guide them through that process, someone to support them, someone to make sure they felt that they were part of the IEP team and had the knowledge and information to participate in that. And also to know that they were being listened to and regarded as experts in their child's education and not just a passive observer while the school implemented an IEP that they didn't have a say in.
And that's incredibly empowering for a parent, right? To, well, A, that you have this experience, that you went through this with your daughter and built upon your educational background and your skills. And it's so empowering for a parent, especially when they're coming from this place of fear and love and you want the right thing for your kiddo. And you feel that it's this us against them. Sometimes, unfortunately, we see that. And so to have somebody that can just take that emotional component out of it, not that you don't care and love about this family, but you're able to just say, all right, what is important here? What are our goals? Let's kind of prioritize what needs to take place. And let me educate you on how this whole process is going to look. Right. And so I think that's so incredible for families to have somebody to be able, because it's a different language. The world of special ed, you know, even the most educated folks, it's the world of special ed is a different language. And if you don't understand that language, you're really starting off at a disadvantage, right?
It absolutely is. I mean, I think so much schools get caught up in this teacher speak and the alphabet soup of IEPs and forget that we're talking to human beings who are there because they have a child that they love who needs help. And so you mentioned the love and care. I mean, I actually think that we must approach, this has to start with love and care as the foundation, right? And so parents often need to feel heard and listened to first. And so I always approach it with that empathy. When you first discover that your child has a disability, or if it's the 10th IEP meeting you've been to and you've been doing this for years, it's still emotional. I mean, I'm an expert in special ed, and there wasn't a single IEP meeting I attended for my daughter that I didn't cry during. You know, it's just,
it's your baby.
It's your baby. It's an overwhelming experience. And so parents have to feel heard. It can't just be, I'm walking into this meeting with this group of professionals sitting around a table, and they're just going to tell me what they're going to do for my child. Like there has to be that element where parents are listened to, where their questions are answered, where their concerns are addressed. And so I just think it's so critical that parents are engaged as partners in this process. That's one of the reasons I named my business District Special Education Partners, because I really want parents and schools to partner together. And I want to be sort of the person who helps bring those two together, especially when parents aren't feeling like they've had a real voice in this process.
100%. And, you know, I will often start meetings. If you think about an IEP, you know, if those folks that have been in IEPs, it's this huge table with a lot of different players and a lot of different names, and they all have information about your kiddo. And so I often will start with the parent and just say, what concerns you today? Like, let them be heard, because a lot of times everybody starts talking and the parent is sitting there and it's extremely overwhelming. And like you said, it's just filled with so many emotions, raw emotions. And everybody has something that they're saying that your kid is, you know, not meeting these expectations and is being impacted here. And so let's just start with the parents. What concerns you today? And let's have a conversation so it doesn't feel like a board meeting. And that brings me to that point that you just brought up that is, I think is excellent about you, Laura, is that you talk about supporting schools, you talk about supporting families. And I know for us, Power Up by Learning Essentials supports kiddos with chronic medical conditions. And the reason we started that was because I have a child with medical needs, and that you have the medical community and the school community, and there's these silos, and they're not really talking to each other in a way where it's productive in that sense. And so to have that bridge that you are doing to help schools and families and to bring everybody together in this collaborative, supportive manner is fantastic. And so I think it's fascinating for me that you started District Special Education Partners in the middle of a pandemic. And so I want to know kind of how that is helping. You know, I'm sure you're just so busy in terms of helping families now navigate this extra layer of either hybrid learning or online learning and a mix, and just trying to figure out special education needs in this really different atmosphere that we're operating in right now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, parents are so overwhelmed, whether their child has a disability or not. I don't know a single parent who isn't feeling the stress of this incredible situation that we're in. But what I was hearing from families who have a child with disabilities is just this absolute feeling of being overwhelmed. And there were parents who, within the first couple of weeks of the school year, were saying, I'm ready to throw in the towel. I can't do this. I just want out. And asking, should I just be homeschooling my child completely? I can't do this. Or wondering, am I going to lose any of my child's rights if I say, it's too much. I can't put my child in front of a screen all day long. I need less. But that less needs to be more, if that makes sense. Like, make the time you have with my child really count versus just having them sit and do these lessons all day long. Or parents who felt like, I have to be by my child's side the entire time because I'm worried they'll miss something or they can't access what's happening without me there. You know, normally it's a child who has a dedicated aide and the dedicated aide's not there next to them. So I'm turning into their dedicated aide. So there's just so much that parents are going through. And all I can say is I think in some ways, parents are just trying to survive this moment. Some are starting to think about what will this look like when I return to school, or how do I make sure that if my child has fallen behind, they get what they need to catch up. I think everyone's just in survival mode at the moment.
Oh gosh, yes, they are. That is very true. So let's just talk a second just about online, online and special education, mm-hmm. right? And so what, can you just tell us what an individualized distance learning plan is? And we talk about that alphabet soup and you hear IDLP, which is that individualized distance learning plan. How is that differing from the IEP? You know, who decides what's in it? Kind of all of that information.
Yeah, that's where it gets really confusing for parents, right? So schools are supposed to have created this individualized distance learning plan for children who have IEPs. And it's basically, how am I going to translate that IEP into this virtual learning environment? How will we implement it? What's going to look different? What's going to look the same? Ideally, parents should have a large say in what that IDLP says. Unfortunately, what I'm hearing in some schools' stance is that, no, we craft the IDLP. It's not something parents have any input into, and it's just presented to the parent. You know, I would certainly encourage parents, if that's the message they're getting from the school, to challenge that. If that individual distance learning plan isn't working for their child, I would absolutely want parents to advocate, to talk to the school, to say, this isn't working, it needs to be modified, and to have that open conversation. You know, I think, again, with parents being in that survival mode, some of them are thinking, okay, it just is what it is, and not necessarily knowing that, no, you can go back to your school, you can talk about how this is just creating frustration for my child, or this piece is working really well, but this other component isn't working well. How can we modify that? Or, you know, my child's IEP says they should get 60 minutes of speech therapy and you've only put 30 minutes on their schedule. I want that full 60 minutes. How can we do it? Or conversely, I don't want that full 60 minutes. It's too much work on me. Can we scale that back to just 30 minutes a week? Because that's going to work better for me. So parents should certainly feel empowered to be talking to their schools about that individualized distance learning plan and make sure it's something that is actually working for their child.
Should parents expect their child's IEP to be fully implemented during the pandemic?
So what the education department at both the state and federal level have said is that schools are responsible for continuing to provide what's called FAPE, again, that alphabet soup, the free and appropriate public education that is the guiding principle of the Individuals with Disabilities and Education Act. What that looks like in principle has varied. Schools have some flexibility to implement the IEP in different ways. And again, that should be a conversation with the parent. And what I would say is if the school is not fully implementing the IEP, then there should actually be an IEP meeting where that's discussed as to why can't we implement it? What modifications are we making that would allow us to better implement that plan? And how can we move forward? It shouldn't just be this wholesale, we can't do it, we're giving you this distance learning plan instead. That IEP should still be the guiding principle behind the child's education, with them thinking through, okay, we're in this virtual learning, how do we make it really work as best we can for the child, knowing that depending on the child, it may not be perfect. We know that no matter how well a school is doing, there are going to be some students who just don't do well with virtual learning, but we've got to try to make it the best that we possibly can. And we have to individualize what we're doing for our kids with disabilities.
And so we know from those individualized education plans and just exactly what you said, we know that needs drive services, mm-hmm. right? So what are some creative solutions? I know some people, parents, professionals may be listening and just wondering, what are some creative ways, kind of out of the box, that we can still really provide that free and appropriate education? We can really honor those individualized educational needs to help support our kiddos. So what have you seen out there that have just, you thought, wow, that's a new way to do it and really is working beautifully? What are some successes, I guess?
Yeah, absolutely. And there have been successes. And I was very fortunate, and I think it's helped my work now in that I was running a student support program when the pandemic hit. So we were in that position of, with 2 weeks' notice, we've got to create a system that's going to work for our students. And I was actually really proud that we did put in place programming that worked really well for a lot of our students who had special needs. And I think it's that willingness to be creative and to think outside the box, to not be tied to, this is our regimented schedule. This is when your child is going to sign onto this and their whole class is on at this time and your child has to be on at this time. So when we got flexible and we thought, you know, this student really does well with one-on-one attention. So we're going to carve out time during the school day where the special ed teacher is just going to have that half hour where they're meeting one-on-one with the student. And what we actually found for some of those students, particularly who had ADHD and were often distracted in the classroom, they were producing more work during remote instruction than they had during the regular school year. That one-on-one time really worked so well for them. Other things that we've had to see much more of is parent coaching and training, which obviously does put some onus on parents. But I think what a lot of parents don't realize is that parent coaching and training has always been an authorized service under IDEA that parents could ask for and that schools could give, but schools rarely ever give that. And so I am pleased that more schools are starting to at least acknowledge that that's a route. Now parents have to have the time and the readiness to take on that role. But I found that when service providers and teachers are really giving some of that coaching to the parents on how best to support their child, that can also work really well. I just read an article about something that took that a step forward. Instead of the service provider, I think in this case, it was a speech therapist doing teletherapy with the child. They instead were on with the parent. The parent was just wearing headsets, so the child couldn't even see the speech pathologist, but the speech pathologist was giving real-time coaching to the parent in how to interact with their child. And they made it really play-based and fun. So the child was enjoying themselves. They didn't feel like it was a therapy session. There was no electronics in sight. So the child's not staring at a screen. It just was, we're going to learn through games. And the parent is learning how to interact with their child. And that's something they can take forward when that therapy session ends and do every single day. So I loved that idea. And I would definitely encourage service providers to think about ways to incorporate that more into their sessions.
Absolutely. And I've heard of behavioral folks doing that, but it was more in their office and they would have hidden cameras and they would have the earpiece and they would be able to real time do this parent coaching and training for the behavioral aspect. But to do that for speech language, I've also heard very similar, the same experience for occupational therapy. It's actually quite a gift if you want to, you know, just think of a silver lining in this whole pandemic and situation of stress, that it's giving that power, again, back to that empowering the parent to understand how to really support their child, whether it's speech language, occupational therapy, physical therapy, teaching them in an educational setting how to empower the parents. They then better understand their child, and then they can take those skills and they're outside playing and they can still continue that quote unquote therapy and build that area and truly then help propel that student forward.
Absolutely. And I have heard parents talk about that silver lining of where they understand their child's learning style more. And some schools have really done a tremendous job of building that relationship with the parents. And parent engagement has always been something that is super important. We know the research shows that when parents are engaged, their child does better. But now schools, I think as well, are really seeing the benefit and building true partnerships, not just, hey, can you show up for the parent-teacher conference or can you volunteer for this event we're hosting? But you are a co-educator with us and you know your child so well. How can we work together? And so if that carries over post-pandemic, that will absolutely be a silver lining. And to the point of therapy, absolutely, yes, this is something that can be done with physical therapy, occupational therapy, behavioral support. And what you were referring to is something called parent-child interaction training. And that is so powerful. There's no reason we can't take that to the home setting instead of the office setting. Another silver lining is with teletherapy. A lot of parents who couldn't access services outside of school for their child now have an easier way to do that, right? It's much less time consuming to just get someone on the computer than to have to take off time from work and drive to an office and then get your child back home. And a lot of parents were kept out of accessing resources. So again, when this pandemic is over, I think teletherapy is something else that's here to stay and can really be a benefit to families.
So let's pivot just a little bit to behaviors, right? So we talked about services and how to support our kids. How should schools and parents address new behaviors that might have arisen during this period of remote learning? You know, we've seen some kiddos that really have grown in this kind of new environment. And we've seen some kiddos where this is not the best environment for them, just the not necessarily the environment, but the style of having to interact with their peers and with their teacher through a screen. Then behaviors have arisen. So what are you seeing and what are your parents saying and how are you helping them bridge that gap and address those new behaviors?
So parents are saying that many of their children are really rejecting this whole I'm going to learn through a computer thing. So I hear from parents about their child, when that laptop comes out, the child will run from the room or start throwing a tantrum. And of course, again, we're talking about children who have significant disabilities. And so this emotional stress of my world is turned upside down, I can't connect with my teacher, you're making me stare at a screen, it's just overwhelming for them. So for children who have an IEP, schools absolutely have the responsibility to address this behavior because it's part of the learning environment they're in now. It can't just be the parents' responsibility to address this. So parents should first bring this to the attention of the school if the school doesn't know that it's happening, and request an IEP meeting to talk about how am I going to get support to address this. So schools will obviously need data. They may not be seeing this if it's not happening live in front of the teacher. So it's important for parents to gather data about when is this happening, what is occurring, what does it look like, what has the parent tried, what's worked, what hasn't worked, and for the IEP team to then figure out what are the supports they're going to put in place, whether that is the parent coaching and training from the school counselor to really assist the parent in knowing how to best address these behaviors, or is it modifying the environment? Again, are we asking too much of this child? Do we need to reconfigure how we're providing this support? And maybe instead of so much screen time, we're sending home manipulatives and books to read and other engaging hands-on materials. And then we provide that little bit of screen time with the teacher to kind of walk through how to do it. Or again, if parents are able to coach the parent in how can you do this, it's going to have to be individualized again, because every family situation is different. Every child is different. So that IEP team really needs to think through what does this particular child need and how does it fit this family situation so that it's a workable solution for the parent to implement.
I love that in terms of it's such a strong message, right? What does this child need? And a workable solution, a doable solution for that parent, because every home life right now is very different in terms of trying to implement school and to work and feeling so overwhelmed and parents feeling that they can't support their child. I do want to ask you, you mentioned collecting data, right? And so something as a special education teacher, you're always collecting data on your students so that you can then improve and make sure that you're supporting them. And in this time of a pandemic that we're now asking parents to collect this data so that they can then, again, be empowered and have that conversation and be a player at the table and have a seat at the table in the way that they need to. How do you recommend to your parents to collect data? Where do they even start? What does that mean? And it's, again, really hard for a parent, I think, when you're not in that frame of mind that this is what you do. Where do they even start and how do they even know to start collecting data? They just know that I pull out the laptop for school and my kiddo is falling apart and this is happening and these feelings are real and, you know, then that causes stress. So how are we able to kind of separate that to provide a tool, an empowering tool for parents so they can easily collect the data so they can then have that conversation with the school?
That's such a great question. And, you know, even as I say, parents collect data, I feel horrible because that's one more thing we're asking parents to have to do in this situation where they're already doing.
And it's hard. It's your baby.
It's so hard and it's so much. And I will just say as much of, you know, I've been a special ed expert, you know, worked in this field for 20 years. And there were so many things at home for my child I knew were best practice. I knew I should do. And I just couldn't bring myself to do them because it's exhausting and it's hard and who wants to do one more thing? And so I recognize that when I say, you know, collect some data, I imagine parents are like, are you kidding me? That's the last thing I can do right now. So I would say, you know, you, again, it comes down to what's manageable for you. It could be, you know, I keep a little piece of paper and when my child throws a tantrum, I put a note and then when they end the tantrum, I look at my watch, oh, that was 10 minutes. And I just kind of make a little notation, 10 minute tantrum when math started. So, you know, it has to be something simple and workable. Schools should be able to provide parents with some simple little charts where they could record some data. So I would start there and just say, hey, I'm kind of seeing this. You asked when's the right time to know. I think anytime a parent has a concern. If you are seeing something at home that worries you, talk to the school about it. There's never a wrong time to bring a concern to the school team. So if you have in the back of your mind, like, I'm not sure this is what I should be seeing, or this doesn't feel quite right, listen to that voice. So often as parents, we talk ourselves back, or we're like, I don't want to, you know, make a big deal out of this, or, oh, the teachers already have so much they're doing, and they do. But listen to that intuition. If something doesn't feel right to you, talk to the school about it, ask for a meeting and figure out what can be done, and ask the school, how can I collect data? What's an easy way to do that? The school should have professionals on staff who can help guide the parent. Certainly, I have forms and charts and can work with parents to do that kind of thing if parents are looking for that external support.
That's right. And then, you know, just as a parent, giving yourself that grace.
Yes.
Right. You know, it's so hard to do. I think as a mom, you know, you tend to just think through different things that you've said and you've done. And so, you know, I think now is a time to really just give ourselves the grace to do the best that we can in this unprecedented situation, to figure out what is manageable for your situation. You know, obviously reach out to you, to advocates that can help you with that external support, reach out to the school, to the case manager for that support. What do you think is the most important thing for parents and schools to do to support students?
Ooh, that's a great question. Again, it really comes down to knowing the child, listening to the parent, coming together to think about what is right for this particular child. You have to be flexible and creative. And, you know, I've used this phrase, I think, a couple of times, but thinking outside the box, right? These are unprecedented times. And I would say the good news, I suppose, is that we don't have to be bound by the things that we've done in the past, right? We can chart a new course and we can really think about what does this child need in this moment? And if we take that approach and schools are really willing to go down that path, we can do things that work well for our children. They're not going to work well for everyone. You know, what's been particularly heartbreaking is the children who are nonverbal or who have such extreme physical needs that they really need that one-on-one in-person support and attention. There just isn't a whole lot virtually that we can do, and that breaks my heart. But for all of our other students, there really are things, if we're willing to get creative, if we're listening to parents, if we're listening to the student. I want to emphasize too that students are the best source of information. Even our little ones, like, they will tell you what works well and what doesn't. And we need to do a better job of listening to the children and what they're telling us. And I also want to come back to that phrase you used about having grace. We hear that a lot, and it's so important. And to me, grace means, you know what, if you need a day where you're just turning off the screen and you're eating ice cream and sitting outside in the sun, that is okay. I had this one parent who had talked about, you know, I've given up on a lot of the schoolwork and I'm taking my child for walks, and we built this model birdhouse and we found these new recipes and we're measuring out the recipes and we're reading books together. And I thought, you are educating your child. That is fantastic. You're probably giving them a better education doing that than they were getting through the screen. So that parent was feeling a little bit guilty about the choice that she had made to cut back on school and worried about its impact. And I just thought, you know, how wonderful that you're in a situation where you can do those things with your child and you can bring joy and spontaneity and learn through these really hands-on real life situations. And again, that's where that silver lining comes in. Not every family is in a position to be able to do those kinds of things, but whatever a family situation, finding those moments for joy, for play, for just putting yourselves first and not worrying so much about, I have to do the right thing. we need those moments where we just allow ourselves to breathe and to have fun.
Absolutely. It is so true. You've shared some tangible examples of outside of the box. And I love that story about the parent that's just taking their kid for a walk and just really taking in what's around them and using that as a teachable moment. That's fantastic. And so I guess two parts to that. What are some additional tangible examples that we can share that you're seeing that's really working? And then my second part to that, which is probably a little more challenging, is what examples can you share for families that don't have that flexibility to spend that much one-on-one throughout the day when they're trying to manage work, even if they're an essential worker and they have to be outside of the home? So I guess kind of what are some tangible examples we can share for families that have some flexibility within their day and then that don't have their flexibility within the day that you're seeing that schools and families are doing that's really helping during this process?
Yeah, I think
that was a very long question.
And it's a great question. And I would come back to some of the things that I have shared already. And clearly, so many of our families are essential workers and don't have that time and that flexibility to provide that level of support that other parents have. And so it really comes down to, again, working with a school to figure out the right plan for that child. And so having those conversations. There's such a disparity in what I see. There are some parents who are getting phenomenal support from their schools and getting all of the things I talked about. And then when I was talking to parents for the blog I wrote, The Ship is Sinking, there was a family that, you know, it was 3 or 4 weeks into the school year and had yet to hear a word from their special ed coordinator. So I would say to those families, you know, reach out. Again, I hate that that onus has to be on the parents. It's not fair. It's not right. And those are the families who have the least time to do it. They're already juggling their children and their job and all of these other things. But if the school has not reached out, if the school isn't providing something that works for your child, there is going to have to be that moment of I'm reaching out and I'm trying to get my school to respond, and hopefully schools will. I'm such an optimist and I believe the best in people. And I like to think that schools will do the right thing if parents reach out. I know from my own experience that that's not always the case, sadly. So I wish I had some magic wand I could wave that would say, if you just do this, you'll get the result that you want. I know that doesn't always happen. You know, there are places like my program, your program, that are here to support families who need that extra help. I am happy to do free consultations for any family that needs it. Like, my heart is just in, I want every family to know what they can do and steps to take. And so I've never turned away a family that just calls me and says, can I ask you a question? I just need a little advice. What can we do?
That is fabulous. And I think sometimes just providing that sounding board, Lara, that you're doing for your families is amazing, because again, that sense of being overwhelmed and you're juggling everything as a parent in your home. And so to reach out to you and have that sounding board to help prioritize what are the needs and how to express that to the school can really help make your voice be heard. And I'm glad you would also mention, which is the title of our show, The Ship is Sinking, about the experiences of parents with children with disabilities. I love in that blog how you wove in stories of families impacted by learning challenges, fighting for the needs of their child. You quoted a mom, Yolanda. She's a mother of three. She's also caring for her sister's children because she's an essential worker. And she said, I have bill collectors calling me. My children's school is calling me. I feel like I'm the captain of the Titanic right now, and we are going down. So what inspired you to write that? But this is, you know, you're just hearing these stories of families that are thinking the ship's going down and I you know, I need some help.
Yeah. You know, I really was inspired to write that blog because I was hearing so many stories of families who were struggling and feeling like they just didn't know how they were going to make it. And I thought it was important to share those stories and those perspectives so that just as a community, as a world, we know what's happening. We know what our families of children with disabilities are enduring right now. And the title of the blog came from Yolanda's statement. I heard that. I was like, oh my gosh, yeah, this ship is sinking. How do we help our families stay afloat? And so the way I close that blog is by talking about, you know, as we prepare to return children to school, and I know recently schools were thinking about returning some students and now they've pulled back on that for safety reasons, which I completely understand. But my point was that we have to prioritize bringing back our highest needs students. And I've been concerned as I hear about these hybrid models that are, again, this one size fits all. Half our students come back for 2 days a week. The other half come back the other 2 days a week. And I thought about the students for whom remote learning is just not working at all or working poorly. And I thought, if that's the model we adopt, then we're basically throwing up the surrender flag and saying, well, it's okay that 3 days a week, these children aren't going to get the support they need to learn. If we're able to bring students back into the building, we need to bring back the students who aren't accessing remote education. And that's many of our students with disabilities. It could include our English language learners. It could include our children who have poor internet access or whose parents are essential workers and who aren't there to guide their children during the day. Let's really look at who needs that in-person learning the most and prioritize bringing them back. And I'm really pleased to see that some schools are adopting that model. I think it's so important, and I hope that when conditions are right, that we are able to safely bring students and teachers back into the building, that we continue to look at who needs to come back first and what's going to work best for them and prioritize the needs of those students.
What do you think has been the most beneficial resource for families who are navigating services within the school?
Right now, it's hard to pinpoint one. I think for families who are interested just in learning more about disability and ways that they can support their child, I love the website understood.org. It's got great, easy to access articles and information. It's even got interactive simulations. So if you want to understand what it's like to have a learning disability in reading or an attentional disability, you can go to those simulations and walk through them. And they have a lot of just really good concrete ideas that, that parents can implement. So I would say if parents are new to this process or want new perspectives, it's got a wealth of resources to draw on. And I love that they've also started building out their resources for teachers and schools as well, because that's so important. So I love that there are more online resources now, and I definitely steer parents and teachers to those.
In your opinion, how can we best support students receiving support services through virtual learning?
I'm trying to think if I have something new or different to say. I'm going to keep coming back to, it depends on the child.
Yeah.
Right. We have to look at what I might answer for one parent is not the same as what I might answer for another parent whose child is completely different. And so I'm going to say, come back to talk to parents, talk to the children, figure out what's doable. I know that many schools have limited resources in terms of personnel, but how can we deploy our people in the best way that's going to meet those individual needs? I can't just say, well, this worked for this one child, so it'll work for this other child, because I don't
never.
Know that it will.
Never, yeah. Right? You can never do that for sure. So no. With all of your advocacy, what's the biggest area you're curious about and why?
I am really curious, and this is sort of outside the context of remote learning and COVID, of why with all of the advances we have in our understanding of learning disabilities, attentional disabilities, autism, why are kids who have IEPs are still not achieving the way we know they're capable of? That really weighs on me. You know, I ran a really good school program. I was so proud of the work that we did. And yet our students with disabilities still weren't achieving, many of them, on the same level as their peers who didn't have IEPs. And so I really am trying to explore more, what is causing that gap and how do we close it? October was Learning Disabilities Awareness Month that just ended. People might be forgiven if they didn't know that because there's a lot of other things going on. But I really started to just look at this more. There's a great report that came out a couple of years ago called The Opportunity Myth. And it talked about how so many of our students, and particularly students with disabilities, students who are English language learners, our Black students, are not getting the four key things they really need to succeed. And that is quality instruction, high expectations, grade level appropriate assignments. And, you know, why aren't these things happening? You know, I've read some research that unfortunately teachers hold lower expectations for their students with disabilities. And if you start with low expectations, we know that people rise to the level of your expectations, right? So if your expectations are way down here for kids with special needs, and they're up here for all your other students, your kids with special needs aren't going to succeed. And I think some of that is well-intentioned, right? We don't want to see our children struggle and be frustrated. And so the way that we often approach it is by lowering the bar instead of keeping the bar high, but providing the necessary supports and services that help the child access that bar without the frustration. And so how can we change teacher attitudes and expectations, which they may not even be aware that they hold, right? We've learned a lot in recent years about unconscious bias and how it affects many different groups. And particularly for our Black students who have disabilities, where you have these intersecting areas of bias that might be impacting. So I am really interested in exploring that more and working with schools on how do we raise expectations, but also how do we make sure that teachers have a strong enough understanding of disability so that they're providing the right supports and tools for those children so that they can succeed and meet those expectations.
Ooh, that's a lot. And that's a huge umbrella. So how does one go about learning more about that? And how do we raise awareness, you know, in terms of improving that, the quality, the high expectations, the implementation of grade level, in a way it comes back to that word individualized, and really having that time to pause, to look at that student's needs, look at their abilities, and how do we grow their abilities? How do we help them highlight their abilities so that they can truly shine on what they know?
Yeah, I think we just start having those conversations. This wasn't even something that I really had thought about until I was putting together a training on discipline and behavior. And of course, I knew a lot already about how we over-discipline children with disabilities and particularly over-discipline boys of color. And as I started doing some research around that and looking at statistics, that was when I came across this wonderful report that I mentioned, The Opportunity Myth, and started thinking about this idea of low expectations. And so I've just been doing more research on that. And then, you know, you start peeling back the layers. So then I came across this research that showed, you know, the survey of some 85,000 gen ed and special ed teachers that, you know, where teachers were saying, no, we don't think that students should meet the same standards if they have a disability. And then you peel that back and you find the research that says, teacher expectations before they start teaching impact the ultimate achievement of students. And so you start seeing this pattern. And actually, the blog I'm working on right now is all about this. So I think we have to start spreading the word. I'd love to start putting together some trainings and really train school staff and teachers about this, just the way we've been exploring implicit bias when it comes to race. I think we also have to look at the intersection of disability and start exploring implicit bias when it comes to students with disabilities and how is that holding our students back. And then we have to couple that with better training for our gen ed teachers. So again, as you said, it's a lot. It's not an easy overnight solution. There's so much work to be done, because my fear is, okay, we raise expectations, but we don't put the supports in place. We will set our kids up for failure. And then you'll see more behaviors, more frustration. And so it can't be one or the other, right? It has to be higher expectations and at the same time, high level of supports that help our kids get to where they need to go. You can't do one without the other. If you just give supports but a low bar, then we're in some ways almost disabling our children more because we aren't expecting more of them. And we might be over-supporting when the bar is already low. So it's a great question, Wendy. How do we bring those two things together? It's something I'm going to be working on, and I hope that more people will start exploring this. I'd love to be, you know, part of that journey. If folks listening to this are affiliated with schools, I would love to explore this with you and figure out how do we train our school staff around this.
So kind of still along that vein of advocacy, what should I have asked you that I didn't know enough to ask? We've kind of really threaded a lot into our conversation today in terms of just advocacy and helping parents and being overwhelmed and working with a system and working together collaboratively. And you just shared a lot of wealth of information in terms of bringing light to where we are to help improve our approach to supporting students with a variety of learning needs and differences. But what should I have asked that I just didn't know enough to ask?
You've asked really great questions today, Wendy. So if there's a question, I might not know enough to know that you should have asked it.
All right, then. So you mentioned you were a single mom, are a single mom. You talked about your daughter being, she's now older. Mm-hmm. If you could turn back the time and talk to your younger self starting this journey, what would you tell her?
Oh my goodness. I would tell myself to have more fun, to enjoy my beautiful daughter more than I did. And I think it's the same advice that I would give to any parent as well. I was so caught up in, I have to do the right thing. I have to help propel my daughter's progress. She was a toddler when she was diagnosed. And of course, we know early intervention is so important. But I was so like, I've got to do this. The OT tells me I need to bounce her on this bouncy ball to improve her core strength. And she'd be screaming and crying. And I was just so torn between, do I do this thing that I'm told I should do? Or do I listen to my daughter who's telling me, please stop this, mom, this is awful. And gosh, it was just so gut-wrenching to be caught in that space. And I took everything so seriously. And I think that was true so much over the years because I felt like I was constantly having to fight for my daughter and battle for her. And I think I lost a lot of the joy that could have come with parenting. There were still certainly plenty of moments of joy, but I think I really got caught up in doing the right thing. And I'm doing air quotes here as I'm talking, whatever that means, right? And lost track of the bigger picture that this was my beautiful, sweet, joyful daughter and that I should just enjoy her for the amazing human being that she is. And, you know, it's hard to remind yourself of that. And so looking back, Certainly, I wish I could say, just lighten up a little bit, Laura. It's going to be okay. She's just going to be the person that she is and just enjoy the moment more.
And that is such a hindsight statement, right? I think just for me as a mom doing that as well. So if you could have a billboard with one tip for parents, what would it be and why?
Oh, that's such a great question. And I knew you were going to ask it, and I still can't quite come up with that one billboard ticket. I do think it would be just enjoy your child. And maybe that's contradictory to where I've talked about the need to, you know, gather data and talk to your school and be an advocate. But stepping back from all of this, you have an amazing human being that you created, and enjoy them for the unique, wonderful person that they are.
It's beautiful. It really is. And it is important to just try to pause at some point during our crazy, chaotic day and remind us of that. So having a billboard with that would be phenomenal, just as our reminder to take that mindful moment of it's going to be okay. And it's all going to work out. And again, to give yourself that grace. Well, it's such a pleasure to chat with you, to have you provide your insight and the fantastic work that you're doing and supporting families and empowering families. So I really appreciate you taking time out of your day to have a conversation with us. And it's my hope that folks that are listening will gain some insight and to feel that they have some knowledge to help continue to do that hard work of supporting our kiddos that really are needing that support from us.
Yeah, thank you for having me here today. It's been a pleasure talking with you, and I hope that parents find something useful in this conversation.
Thank you for joining us today for our IEP Essentials Pro Tips podcast. To hear more pro tips and find additional IEP essentials, including our IEP webinar, please visit www.learningessentialsedu.com.